y'all? This is Jeff Wifferson coming at you from New Zealand here in Golden Bay. I'm sitting here at a picnic table beneath a beautiful giant eucalyptus tree. Actually, several of them that have become some of my very dearest friends here. And I'm looking out at the ocean, at Farewell Spit and a lovely pahutukawa tree. It's Thursday, the 21st of December, 2017. The show is called Greetings for All Seasons, Galactic, Solar, Terrestrial, and Eternal. You might hear that rooster crowing in the background, even though it's about 6 p.m. It's cock-a-doodle-doo time. And it's very interesting because I'm going to talk about time, how we reckon what we call time, natural time versus machine time, seasons and sacred moments in time, and the fact that tomorrow morning at 5:30 a.m. it's the austral summer solstice and the boreal winter solstice. But people have, for a long time, used the crowing of a rooster to mean that it's time to get up, or other such early morning appointments, like if it was your day to be hanged or something, you were going to be shot at the crowing of the rooster. You know, so it's like, I never liked the sound of roosters. I don't have a problem with chickens. I don't really have a problem with roosters, but I don't really like to be somewhere where there's roosters around, mainly because they don't just do their cock-a-doodle-doo at sunrise. They can do it any hour of the day or any hour of the night. Anyway, I want to wish everyone of all kingdoms of life, my family, Mitukaye Oyasan, all my relations, beautiful seasons greetings for all seasons. Galactic seasons, solar seasons, terrestrial seasons of Mother Earth, and the greatest season of all, eternity, which is the macro holographic season that enfolds and encompasses all the other seasons. And it's interesting that this right now, I mean, technically, it's always now, no matter what time it might be according to your iPhone or your wristwatch, no matter what numerals are being displayed, it's always now. It can't not be now. You can refer to things that already happened, moments in time from bygone minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, years, or centuries, or even eons, but that doesn't change. It's cock-a-doodle-doo o'clock. That doesn't change what time it is now. It's always now. So now, it's very similar to here. Now, these are words in English and other languages, especially non-European, non-symbolic languages, may have completely different sort of concepts. But no matter where you are and when you are, to you, it's always now and you're always here. Because you can't be somewhere else other than where you are, and it can't be any time other than now when you're there. So, but how much of our whole mentality is constructed around and founded on our myriad conceptualizations and simulations of things, events, people, and processes that are not here and not now? A lot. In fact, probably the vast majority of it. Whereas in the admonition of Richard Albert, aka Ram Dass, he published this really cool book called Be Here Now. So in a way, we don't have any choice but to be here now. But if you're consciously here now, it makes things a lot more harmonious and coherent. So this, today, just in the past 3 or 4 days, it's been the new moon. It's been the summer solstice down under, in about less than 12 hours from now. Then, on this coming Monday, we've got the biggest Western civilization holiday of the year called Christmas. Then a week later, New Year's Day. So we could actually talk at length about what Christmas is and where that comes from, and New Year's Day and the whole idea of calendars, the Gregorian calendar versus the Mayan calendar or the calendar of any other indigenous culture and what it was based on. I can't claim to have any real understanding of any of this, except that I know that the word calendar comes from the Latin word calends, C-A-L-E-N-D-S, that means taxation. So the Roman calendar was invented to tell people or the officials when it was time to collect taxes from people. So that's very interesting. All along there's been an intimate relationship between time and money. But in the immortal phrasing of who I consider to be a pretty cool person, and even though he sort of went off the deep end, but you can think of him as the Mayan scholar Jose Arguez, he liked to say time is art, which is much closer to reality, because as a whole, time would be contrasted with simultaneity, which is probably how the universe actually is. Everything is simultaneous in eternity. It's just that our minds, our perceptual apparatus, our reality management systems aren't vast enough or complex enough to grasp this simultaneous wholeness in all its complexity. So we have to experience things in sequential orders called time. Or we have more sort of right hemisphere experiential dimensions of time that are more simultaneously oriented. But usually our day-to-day experience of time is sort of a combination of these two modes, kind of shifting back and forth. Like I find myself pretty much on right hemisphere, timeless mode, a great deal of the time. There you go, you can't get away from that word. But when you've got to deal with deadlines and appointments and dates and things like that, you have to stay synchronized in with at least what day it is and what the time is, if you're supposed to meet somebody or you have an appointment and that kind of thing. But I really enjoy being timeless. I think that historically, human people and other beings who might reckon time have done so fundamentally with respect to astronomical events, observations, and processes. For example, the most salient one is the diurnal, nocturnal, day-night cycle that we go through every day and every night. Unless you're at a polar latitude near the winter or summer, when you might have days, weeks, or months where you don't have day or where you don't have night. So that would be very interesting, because say like if you're living in northern Norway, it might be partially dark or partially light for several months, but you still have the phases of the moon coming and going through all that. So that must be very interesting to experience, interspersed with some aurora borealises and other cosmic beautiful phenomena like that. But astronomical time would be a observed or acknowledged, honored, or measured, because it represents the perception of motion, relative motion of planetary bodies, and the associated geometries that these motions describe or trace out. So we've got, in our heliocentric model of the solar system, we've got the sun, we've got the planets rotating pretty much in a plane around the sun. Each planet has its moons that rotate around it. You've got heaps of asteroids and comets orbiting the sun at much more elliptical orbits, coming in at a lot of different angles. So, what we call a year is the length of time that an object takes to make a complete cycle or revolution around the sun. Measuring time with respect to astronomical cycles makes a lot of sense, and it's a direct connection with the rhythms of nature. And I think it's one of the coolest things that ancient peoples did and do. But you've also got the ability to reckon time qualitatively. But if you're reckoning time in terms of astronomical cycles, say, like, if you want to reckon long periods of time that span distances greater than a human lifetime, you've got to be able to symbolically and or physically remember this information somehow in a way that makes sense. So possibly this could be the origin of mathematics. But that's another whole story in itself. But in addition to astronomical reckoning of time based on cycles and motion, you could have the reckoning of time based on qualitative differences in various variables or parameters of existence. Like, for example, what we call geological time. Not only were the first climatologists geologists, but the first chronologists were probably either astronomers or geologists as well. Because our whole reckoning of very long periods of time, going way far back into the day and before the day, are based on geological evidence, fossils and strata of minerals, and it's quite scientific, but it's all not based on a direct measurement of the amount of time that's gone by. It's deduced from information that we believe expresses or encodes this information. For example, not counting all the geological evidence, you've got chronodendrology, which is the study of tree rings. Now, what if there was a really dry year or some other circumstances occurred where the tree didn't grow very much and maybe didn't make a ring? Which we have no way of knowing. It's all on the assumption that a tree is going to have a ring in its cross-section for every year. But that's an assumption. We don't know that to be an absolute fact. So all of our knowledge and information is based on this kind of assumption. For example, the correlation between the random variables of what's believed to be a global average temperature and the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, why anyone chose those two things to be interrelated or to look at is a very interesting story in itself, because there's many other variables that you could look at in studying an ice core sample. You could look at the measured variation in levels of probably thousands of different substances. And you could even correlate that with variations in temperature, but you could also correlate it with variations in other variables, not temperature. You could correlate the relative level of nitrogen with the salinity of the ocean, or the relative level of oxygen with the barometric pressure. So, you see what I'm saying? We've been led down these roads that we don't even question. Everything's a lot more complex than we care to admit, or that we have time to deal with. So that makes us all the more susceptible to swallowing predigested bites of knowledge, wisdom, and information from authoritative sources. And there you go. That's the story of reality as we know it. But if you reckon time qualitatively, you might say that, for example, the period from this date to that date is the period of when we seem to be receiving a certain type of energy from the sun, or, you know, some other kind of cosmic source. I think that there was aspects of the Mayan calendar that were kind of like this, as I understand it. It could be total bullshit on the part of people like Carl Kalman, for example, but you don't really know. It's interesting to think about. But qualitative time would be different from quantitative time. Qualitative time would be the, say, like if it was really hot for a few hours, or if it was really hot for a few days, you'd say, oh, this was the period of when it was really hot. Or you could even specify, this was the period during which the temperature varied on average from 18 degrees to 28 degrees. See what I'm saying? So it's how we break down time and categorize it and conceptualize it is completely a figment of our imagination. So there's nothing, I'm not going to say it's not real, but it's really breaking down a continuous spectrum of complexity into mathematically encoded bits of data and information that don't exist outside of our mind. Hence, our whole kind of cultural obsession with specific dates, and especially all the Hallmark greeting card dates of like Mother's Day and Father's Day and Earth Day and George Washington's birthday and the Queen's birthday and all the stuff. And I mean, you know, birthdays in general, I mean, technically, your birthday is the day you were born. And every repetition of that same date in subsequent years is not really your birthday. It's the anniversary of your birthday. So at least in French, they call it your anniversaire. So we get so much wrong about everything we try to do. When geologists are studying what they think happened on the Earth a long time ago, they have sometimes been thrown off the track because they'll go like, well, there's a whole strata of fossils that's just not there. And something like this happened with the reckoning of the what they call the Cambrian explosion, which, according to the fossil record, represents an almost instantaneous explosion of new life forms all over the world, out of nowhere, and instantaneous in a geological time sense. But I've seen researchers say that that could be an illusion. It wasn't all the reason it just looks like that because the several strata of fossils that would have been laid down during the previous epochs were somehow missing or destroyed, possibly by a planetary upheaval or cataclysm, or they're just not located in the position or location where they would be expected to be. So therefore, the whole temporal reckoning would be thrown off. In the same way that Emanuel Velikovsky correlated events that are clearly described in the cultural histories and mythologies of a lot of, for example, Middle Eastern cultures. And he said that these sequences of natural catastrophes all line up in a pattern, and they're the same pattern in these different cultures, but the timeline is different. So he thought, which I believe accurately, that he could, if he lined up these patterns of natural catastrophes, then that would show an accurate correlation of the real timeline of these cultures. But just the fact that all this stuff is just a couple of thousand, 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, and it's that we're that confused about the timeline of it, just goes to show, you know, it's all a function of our memory. Whether it's memory inside of our brain, or the Akashic record, or written down, transcribed, and recorded somehow, it's all forms of memory. Another interesting thing with respect to the reckoning of time is, again from Emanuel Velikovsky, he said that in observing that the Earth has been bombarded by massive radiation storms from solar and extrasolar sources throughout her life, that all or some of these bombardments had the potential to sort of reset the atomic clock of all the radioactive elements that scientists now use to measure time. Or the rate of decay, for example. We measure time according to the rate of decay of different isotopes. And like the speed of light and the gravitational coefficient, these numerical values are held to be constant. But Emanuel Velikovsky said that, you know, after one big radiation storm could change the decay rate of all these isotopes and thereby throw off any subsequent reckoning of time, because that decay rate, say like if we measure how old a rock is based on its existing rate of decay of a certain isotope, but if that rate was changed 30 million years ago, it might have been completely different. So the age of the rock and the age of everything could actually be vastly different than we think. It's cock-a-doodle clock now. I just paused to watch and communicate with a really tiny, interesting-looking little spider that came and jumped on my hand and then on my shoulder. I just saw an interesting video by George Carlin, the philosopher-comedian, and he had some really cool things to say, but he was talking about the what you might call the hubris of humanity, or the, he used the word conceit, and I used the word species megalomania, but how pretentious and delusional it is for humans to think that we're gonna save this or save that. And you know, he's quite cynical, and he never talked about having a sense of the sacred in terms of our relationship with our fellow beings and Mother Earth. But he did make some really good points that, I mean, he was sort of downplaying any damage that humanity might be doing to Mother Earth, because, and I see what he means. I mean, he never mentioned, he didn't really go into it scientifically, but he said, like, if he was basically talking about on the scale of things that we're doing, far, far, far worse catastrophic things have happened in the history of the Earth. Things I talk about a lot, like radiation bombardment from space, you know, massive planetary volcanic activity and earthquakes, a lot of these probably triggered by impacts from comets and asteroids. This kind of stuff is par for the course for the history of Mother Earth. And so, life herself has made it through all of these cataclysmic events, the mass extinction events. But his point was that we're giving ourselves too much credit to think that we're actually hurting the Earth. And I understand what he means, but I think that there's a lot of subtle energetic things going on that he might not have been aware of. But, you know, we're certainly not. I think we are rendering a large part of Mother Earth not safe for habitation for a lot of life forms. Or we're degrading the quality of life of life forms, and including ourselves. But we're certainly not destroying the Earth. I mean, we are sort of like, I use the example of tumors growing on your body. You know, how much of the surface of your body would you want to be covered with non-living growths happening from something that's actually supposed to be a part of your body? Like that's what cancer would be. So how much of your body would you like to be covered with tumors before you feel like you really need to do something about it? So I think we might be starting to cross that threshold where Mother Earth will, to use the phrase that George Carlin said, shake us off like a bunch of fleas. And I really think that that's true. And the Native Americans and other indigenous people say that this has happened before. But all that kind of misses the point of that we're actually, our true spiritual nature is supposed to be the guardians of life and the caretakers of Mother Earth and of the keepers of our family and their friend, not their enemy, not their predator, not their chef. There's a beautiful little chaffinch right behind me here.
Jeffy, I don't have no fleas for you.
Similar to the chaffinch that would come and busk for bread at my cottage on Great Barrier Island. So I think that what we're doing is we're hurting ourselves and our family of life, and we're beginning to make Mother Earth uncomfortable. We're not in danger of destroying her, but we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing here. We're doing a lot of things that we should never have done, violating the true spiritual path that we were supposed to live by. A lot of people I know for many years have wanted to refer to the quote-unquote age in which we now live as the age of man or the Anthropocene era. And I really beg to differ. This is in our mind, and it's we really give ourselves too much credit for our importance. And even if we look at our significance as a destructive force, compared to all the other life forms that haven't deviated from their true spiritual path, we are a threat to life. We aren't a threat to life herself as a whole, but we are a threat to a lot of larger life forms. The quality of life, the quality of the composition of the air and the water and the soil, the quality of life for our fellow beings and ourselves. And we've become enamored of, entrapped in, and addicted to our own artificial constructs, physically, spiritually, emotionally, and psychologically. And so this is, all of this going on for thousands of years has resulted in kind of a collective dementia, or I call it a species megalomania. A species megalomania in which we think that we're the most powerful beings on the planet. And we might be the most powerful species of life in terms of our ability to destroy, but we glorify that. And I really think that Emmanuel Velikovsky's insight that the rulers of ancient cultures, their highest aspiration was to emulate the gods being the forces of nature, of the cosmos that essentially wrought havoc. The gods waged war on humanity and the earth, and so the rulers wanted to emulate the gods when they waged war, or by waging war, because they thought that's what the gods did. So I think that humanity as a whole, we're entrapped in that same unconscious scenario of seeking to emulate the gods. We want to do all the things that the gods did to ourselves and to our planet unconsciously, because we aren't aware that we're doing it. And I'd like the contrast in summing up the continuity versus catastrophe. Because life herself is really all about continuity. As George Carlin so astutely observed, you know, 99.9% of all life forms that have ever existed are extinct, or so we believe. And he says, well, that's what life does. That's what nature does. So nature is actually a creative process. Life isn't limited to any specific species or manifestations or molecular configurations. Life is a process. Life could be thought of as a being herself, what we call water-based life, the spirit of water-based life. Could be a being. And I don't know if we could give her a name, but I think she's very real. So we don't have to have special moments in time to honor the consciousness of water-based life. That would be the continuity that has been maintained, which is almost as long as we believe the Earth to have existed. We don't have to have holidays in honor of water-based life. We don't have to have a day honoring the day that life was created. Or we do have anniversaries that acknowledge the dates on which massive destruction happened. That's what a lot of holidays are about. For example, the anniversaries of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But we do have sacred moments in time, like the solstices and the equinoxes, which are moments of astronomical significance. The solstices being when, in the northern hemisphere, in the winter solstice, it's the shortest day of the year, and it's the turning point at which the days start to become longer again. And in the summer solstice, it's the opposite. It's the longest day of the year, and then the length of the day starts getting shorter. The equinoxes are the midpoints in the Earth's revolution around the sun, where the day and night are of approximately equal length. So they're sort of nodes in a cycle that would correspond to different kinds of musical phrasing, the music of the spheres. So honoring and acknowledging and expressing this kind of thing, I think, is really, really beautiful. And that's what moments in time like this, where we've got a conjunction of the summer solstice down under and the new moon, and we had the peak in the Geminid meteor shower last week, which was also really, really special. Meteor showers are actually acknowledgments, or the physical encounter with fragments of comets or asteroids that are orbiting the Earth. So in a way, we could measure time with respect to each year could be measured. New Year's could be when we pass through the fragment cloud of Comet Encke, which would be, well, it's actually twice a year. So we could have New Year's twice a year, late June and early July, late October and early November. And if we're going to do that, we may as well add an extra day to each week For 3 weeks out of each month, you could add an extra day called Fun Day that would be a weekend extender between Friday and Saturday, or between Saturday and Sunday, or between Sunday and Monday, Fun Day, that wouldn't change the numerical values of the months, but would be a weekend extender for two or three weeks of every month, except for February. This is just how we've broken it down, but you know, again, the month is based on a lunar cycle, which is 28 days, but there's actually 13 lunar cycles in a solar year. So why does our calendar only have 12? Again, all this arbitrary mismanagement of reality characterizes our demented, delusional operating environment. If we just thought of every moment in time as sacred, we don't even have to divide time up into moments. It can just be one continuous, eternal now that's completely sacred and beautiful. And I think that that's what the Garden of Eden is. That's what heaven is. That's what the dream time is. This living and being here now in a continuous moment of eternal presence. It's possible to have that. Having said that, everybody enjoy the Christmas season with all the parties and jangling jingle bells and giving of gifts and seeing family members that you like and family members that you don't like. And I'd really like to thank all of my beautiful friends all over the world that have been so amazingly supportive of me, always making me possible, but especially this year, and helping me to replace my Nikon camera that got destroyed by Mother Ocean in Tasmania back in February. I've just paid for the new camera yesterday, and they shipped it today, so hopefully sometime next week I'll actually have it. It's only been possible because of help from many, many, many beautiful friends who support me through commissioning artwork for me and giving me money, and it really means just so much. I wish I could spend the rest of my life just doing art to give away to all my friends. So that's a big part of what I'm trying to do. Anyway, I better sign off now. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off. Merry Christmas and happy solstice. And I love all you guys. Oh, and we have a new addition to the family. In addition to Teddy, Wally, Ruby, and Big Teddy, Heidi, and Phil the Fish, we've got a new little puppy dog. His name's Bowser. Bowser, you want to say something? Woof, woof, woof. Whoa, wavy, up. You found me laying by the side of the road the other day on your bicycle, and now I'm a member of your family, and I love being with you. Woof, 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 woof. Okay, little Bowser. Okay, this is Jeff signing off beneath Grandmother Eucalyptus, and I'm looking at Grandmother Pahutakaua, New Zealand's Christmas tree. Greetings from Golden Bay. Hei wahi tapu, wahi arahi mai, ingia tahora. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be happy. Aroha Nui. Ooh.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.